Hello, welcome to the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 20th, 2025. This is the second hour, and I am Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries list. The names today include the following: Mary Cecilia Owen Anderson, Myra Bertelson, Donald Gene Bomer, Douglas Dean Comstock, Dana Berkova Galindo Morales, Laverne Myers Kirk, John D. Kaiser, Sonny Ann Overfield, Stephen Charles Ryan, Paula Marie Schwartz, Jimmy Wood, Duncan McDaniel Woods, Jean McCarty Zimmerman. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed today. We turn now to the business or economy section of the paper. There's two articles today. The first, by Russ Wiles, who is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, is entitled "Multiple Warning Signs of Recession Could Start Flashing at Any Time Now." This is what he wrote: "The scent of recession is in the air, with tariffs likely to cause some painful adjustments and slow the economy. Hardly a day goes by when some economist is not raising his or her recession odds. We are not in a recession yet, but several worrisome signs have emerged, some that might flash false alarms, but others that could signal a slump ahead. Look out for more going-out-of-business liquidations and for sale signs lingering longer on homes in your neighborhood and the spreading homeless encampments and other indicators of stress if the economy weakens from here. However, these conditions have also been apparent during good times and are not among the relatively few early warning signs that are tracked by economists. Even bankruptcy filings can be misleading as a recession harbinger. Filings do increase during recessions, but they have been rising for the past 3 years. Perhaps more telling, consumer inquiries about bankruptcy surged during the first quarter of 2025 to the highest level since 2020. That's according to Legal Shield, which predicts a potential wave of bankruptcy filings this summer. So, what do economists rely on to predict recessions? Much key information can be found in the Index of Leading Economic Indicators compiled by the Conference Board. That's a nonprofit business research group. This index includes 10 indicators, several of which had been weakening even before President Trump announced his tougher tariff policy in early April. So here are some areas that bear close watching. One key indicator relates to stock market trends, as measured by changes in the Standard & Poor's 500 Index. Lower stock prices reflect declining consumer and business confidence. Also, market losses make investors feel poorer and less willing to spend money on non-essential items. When the most recent Conference Board report for February was published in mid-March, the stock market at the time was a positive indicator. Not so anymore. In the aftermath of Trump proposing higher tariffs on April 2nd, the S&P 500 has dropped sharply, down 6% just in the 2 week plus since that announcement. Now, the real estate picture remains generally healthy, despite some concerns, such as an uptick in foreclosures around Metro Phoenix, albeit from low levels, and a rise in cost-burdened tenants, those who spent more than 30% of their income on rent. More favorable signs include the solid median home price averaging $455,000 here, despite more homes up for sale, and a surprising decline in evictions. These and other indicators set the tone for real estate, though the Conference Board does not track them, Rather, to pinpoint the future direction for real estate activity, the group focuses on building permits for private housing. Recent numbers for Metro Phoenix show a mixed picture, with permits up 21% for single-family homes last year, but down 30% for multifamily units. That's according to George Hammond, who's an economist at the University of Arizona. Now, other real estate segments have shown weakness. Office buildings are among the most stressed. For example, 789,000 square feet of office space was under construction as of the fourth quarter of 2024, according to Colliers International. That was the lowest amount in more than 10 years. Now, there were other factors, including remote work policies, likely playing a role. Meanwhile, a new sentiment survey among real estate investors, compiled by RCN Capital and C.J. Patrick Company, well, it's sunk to its lowest level since it started 2 years ago. The survey takes quarterly readings of optimism or pessimism among investors in residential properties. The U.S. unemployment rate stood at 4.2% in March and 4.1% in Arizona. Those numbers are not bad. But jobless rates are not a leading indicator for predicting the direction of the economy. After the economy starts to sour, they will start climbing. To measure the jobs picture on a more real-time basis, the Conference Board tracks average weekly initial claims for unemployment insurance, which were slightly negative as of February. Few Metro Phoenix employers have issued big layoff announcements in recent months, but that could change quickly if the economy weakens. The Conference Board compiles a credit index and tracks the spread or difference between yields on 10-year Treasury bonds minus the federal funds rate. These indicators are somewhat complex, and as of the report published in March, they were flashing mixed signals with no strong trend apparent. If a recession materializes, the normal pattern would be for interest rates to ease. But with inflation expectations also rising, owing largely to higher tariffs, the Federal Reserve could face a tough choice between trying to boost economic activity while trying to keep inflation at bay. During periods of economic weakness, when lending activity slows, consumers with high credit scores can sometimes take advantage of attractive offers. For example, NerdWallet recently highlighted a limited-time sign-up bonus of 100,000 reward points on the Chase Sapphire Preferred card after customers use it to spend at least $5,000 over 3 months. That's up from the prior 60,000-point offer. Now, Americans are feeling uneasy about the economy, and that is showing up in the data. Even before Trump's tariff announcements, consumer expectations were the component that weighed down the leading indicators index most heavily as of the Conference Board's March report. And since then, things have worsened. A more current gauge of consumer sentiment, tracked by the University of Michigan, shows substantial drops in confidence as of early April, as people prepare for what they think will be rising unemployment and inflation. Joanne Hugh, director of consumer surveys at the university, said, quote, "Consumers report multiple warning signs that raise the risk of recession. Expectations for business conditions, personal finances, incomes, inflation, and labor markets all continued to deteriorate," unquote. The Conference Board tracks average number of weekly hours worked in manufacturing industries. As of its latest report, that was the strongest of the leading indicators tracked. Now, whether that trend continues by the time the next report comes out on April 29th is anyone's guess. One key goal of Trump's tariff policy is to boost jobs in American manufacturing, and the expanded commitment by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company in Phoenix is a strong example of a recent success. However, while manufacturing employment may rise, it will take time, possibly years, for some of this improvement to be reflected. Companies just cannot build new factories and hire legions of workers overnight. The Conference Board tracks three other measures to get a sense of the pace of business activity. One is new orders for consumer goods. Another is orders for non-defense capital goods. The group also compiles a separate index that tracks new orders. As of that most recent report published in March, one of these components was showing weakness, another was flat, and the third slightly positive. The Trump administration has changed its tariff policy several times in recent weeks, creating the type of uncertainty that businesses fear. How much tariff policy uncertainty affects orders is an open question. So where do we go from here? Well, a recession has not been officially declared yet. Another non-governmental group called the National Bureau of Economic Research makes that call. However, the Leading Indicators report from the Conference Board has declined slightly for three consecutive months through February. When the group releases its next report on April 29th, further deterioration seems likely. And that was Russ Weil's article, Multiple Warning Signs of Recession Could Start Flashing at Any Time Now. Our second article from the Economy page, USDA Cuts Could Affect Student Meals. This was written by Lily Altavina for the Detroit Free Press and the USA Today Network out of Detroit. Michigan school and agricultural leaders want the food atop plates in school lunchrooms to reflect the diversity of the state's farms. Crunchy apples, starchy potatoes, and obviously deep red cherries. It's why students in the hospitality program at the Muskegon Area Career Tech Center tested potato recipes on a Thursday in April in an effort to successfully process and freeze potatoes grown in Michigan to distribute to schools across Muskegon County. Dan Gorman, the food service director for Montague Area Public Schools and North Muskegon Public Schools on the western side of the state, Dan said, quote, "It's a critical part of trying to get a new infrastructure set up so we can always have local foods in schools," unquote. Around the state, there are signs of a long-building farm-to-school movement. Locally sourced carrots at school lunchroom salad bars and fresh vegetables erupting from gardens tended to by tiny hands on K-12 school campuses. Gorman and others are passionate about this work, work they want to continue so local produce will consistently make it onto students' plates. It's work, they say, will not be interrupted by the Trump administration cuts to the United States Department of Agriculture grants, which includes canceling a grant that could have sent $18 million for the Local Food for Schools program, among the other cancellations. But that cut does hurt. May Supros, Director of Farm-to-Institution Programs at Michigan State University's Center for Regional Food Systems, said, quote, "It would have been monumental for us. It's going to really cut drastically the amount of fresh, local fresh food that we're going to get on kids' plates," unquote. And the wind changes at the federal level have created fear over the idea of even bigger cuts to programs as long-standing as the National School Lunch Program, which some Republicans have opposed. Michigan is one of the most agriculturally diverse states in the country, but a lot of produce is exported out, and school nutrition leaders are trying to get some of the food to stay in Michigan, specifically in school cafeterias. That means food service directors need to work on developing recipes and getting the right equipment to prepare food and planning nutrient-dense, healthful meals. Supro said, quote, school food has gone so much to processed, heat-up, quick-serve stuff with very short lunch periods for students, unquote. Then she went on and said, quote, having a real meal that's cooked from scratch has really, for a long time now, been the minority when it comes to school food. That doesn't create opportunities for local food. So really, it's about educating and getting school food service directors to change the direction, unquote. The USDA plays a major role in the meals public schools serve. It oversees federal funding to public schools of both the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program, as well as smaller grants like Local Food for Schools, which was a pandemic-era program. Gorman said that when a local farmer heard the grant was canceled, they called him to ask how it would affect what the district purchases from farms, particularly because the farmer was considering cross-pollinating their apple trees to produce a smaller apple, one that would be perfect for young appetites and short lunch periods. And he said, quote, that's the win that we're really looking for, where the farms are looking to us to find that niche of their business where they can be successful and do that. And then the schools have a great product that can go to our kids. When these things get yanked away, it's just kind of a step back on those things, unquote. Well, it's not apparent what will happen to the apples, but programs can and will lean on state funding in this case, because Michigan has its own farm-to-school program, 10 cents a meal, which provides grant funding to educational institutions with money to buy produce grown in the state. Now, the food grown at Partridge Creek Farm in Ishpeming in the Upper Peninsula either goes straight to local school cafeterias or to members of the community, many of whom rely on some form of assistance for food, according to Sarah Johnson, who's the executive director of the farm. The farm also puts on gardening education programs at local public schools aimed at helping students grow and prepare their own food. Johnson said, quote, this is important because you're exposing them to fresh local vegetables. They're getting to put their hands in the dirt. They're getting to understand what it takes to grow that food. They're creating a relationship and a connection to it, so they're more likely to try it, unquote. But while a cut to USDA farm-to-school funding is a blow, the looming idea of even more cuts to school food programs and to food affordability programs, that will impact how children interact with food as they grow up. Johnson said, quote, if that's going away, it's going to affect their choices and their impacts, and that can have a cascading effect on health outcomes, unquote. And that was the article, USDA Cuts Could Affect Student Meals. We're coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, so let's move over to the sports section and find out what's on the front page of the sports section. All right, the cover story on the sports section is entitled, Readers Have Voted, Arizona Sports Leaders Approval Ratings. This was written by, what was his name again? Oh, Chris Coppola for the Arizona Republic. Clearly, ASU fans' approval of their coaches is tied to results, so it is no surprise that head football coach Kenny Dillingham had the highest approval rating among the Sun Devils' coaches listed. In fact, Dillingham, who led ASU to the Big 12 championship last season, had the highest approval rating of anyone on the list. 89.6% of the respondents strongly approved of his job performance, and 96% overall either strongly or somewhat approved. But it was a different story for men's basketball coach Bobby Hurley. Those respondents were far more divided. Participants voted 64% combined for somewhat or strongly disapprove of Hurley's job performance, 31% of respondents strongly disapproving, only 36% either strongly or somewhat approved of his performance. Among the other ASU coaches, baseball's Willie Bloomquist drew 82% overall approval, while the new women's basketball coach, Molly Miller, most recently hired after leading Grand Canyon to the NCAA Women's Tournament, had a 92% overall approval rating. ASU's athletic director, Graham Rossini, also fared well, drawing 89% overall approval. But what about the pro teams? Well, the coaches drew more approval than owners in the local pro ranks. Cardinals head coach Jonathan Gannon drew 88% overall approval, while the team owner, Michael Bidwell's performance, was far more divided among readers, 59% overall disapproval and 41% overall approval. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lavullo drew 92% overall approval, with 54% strongly approving. Team owner Ken Kendrick had a nearly 60% overall approval rating. Now, Suns owner Matt Ishbia's approval clearly was influenced by the team's current situation. Our poll was posted on the same day that coach Mike Budenholzer was fired, and that's why we didn't include Budenholzer for this reason in the poll. About 66% of readers overall disapproved of Ishbia's job performance, with 34% strongly disapproving. Now, three other coaches drew strong overall approval: the Mercury's Nate Tibbetts with 71%, and Arizona Basketball's Tommy Lloyd at 79%, and Grand Canyon men's basketball Bryce Drew at 86%. And that was the article, Readers Have Voted, Arizona Sports Leaders Approval Ratings. Our next article from the interior of the sports section is Marciniak hired as Arizona General Manager. Former Lady Vols basketball star Michelle Marciniak has been hired as the General Manager for the University of Arizona's women's basketball program. Marciniak joins the staff of new coach Becky Burke, who was hired on April 9th to replace Adia Barnes. The general manager position is a newer one in college sports. Marciniak's responsibilities will include program operations, staffing, roster management, global recruiting, and NIL development. She will also act as an advisor to Burke on program culture, leadership, and national brand strategy. Marciniak said in a school press release, quote, "This opportunity brings together everything I care deeply about, the business of basketball, leadership, and building something meaningful alongside others. I've been shaped by a championship mindset, and I am committed to contributing in a way that honors the incredible foundation already in place. My goal is to help elevate the Arizona women's basketball brand and build a sustainable national championship program. I'm excited to work together on a thoughtful, strategic path forward." Unquote. The other power conference program to make a general manager hire for women's basketball this spring is Cal. They hired Megan Williams. Duke has had a general manager since June 2022. North Carolina hired one in June 2023. And USC hired one in September of 2024. Marciniak played for the legendary Lady Vols coach Pat Summitt from 1993 to 1996. She was a senior when Tennessee won the 1996 national championship, and she was named the most outstanding player. Marciniak helped lead the Lady Vols to two SEC championships and back-to-back trips to the Final Four. Marciniak played professionally for six seasons in the ABL and the WNBA before becoming a coach. She was an assistant coach at South Carolina from 2003 to 2008. She went on to co-found Sheeks, S-H-E-E-X, with Susan Walvius, who was the head coach at South Carolina when Marciniak was on staff. Sheeks is the world's first performance betting company. It raised more than $25 million in capital as it became a globally recognized brand, and Marciniak was co-CEO of Sheiks for 17 years. That's Marciniak is hired as Arizona General Manager. Our next article, Diamondbacks Look Ahead. Diamondbacks finish road trip, return home to face the Braves. This is written by the Republic staff. The Diamondbacks wrapped their six-game road trip with a Sunday game against the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field on April 20th with a scheduled 11:20 a.m. first pitch. Merrill Kelly, 3-1 record, 5.57 ERA, is scheduled to start for Arizona opposite the Cubs right-hander Jameson Taillon, who is 1-1 with an ERA of 5.40. The Diamondbacks and Cubs split a season-opening four-game series at Chase Field. Following an off day on Monday, April 21st, the Diamondbacks will open their eighth series of the season on April 22nd against the Tampa Bay Rays at Chase Field. That's a three-game set, all games scheduled for a 6:40 p.m. first pitch. Brandon Pfaadt, with a 3-1 record and a 3.04 RBI, is expected to start for Arizona against the Rays' Zach Littell. Did I say RBI? I meant ERA. He's got a record of 3-1 and is 3.04 ERA. Then the Rays' Zach Littell is 0-4 and his ERA is 5.48. He's coming off a 1-0 loss to the Boston Red Sox on April 16th. Pfaadt went 5 2/3 innings with 6 strikeouts and allowing just 1 run in that 6-2 win over the Miami Marlins on April 16th. The Diamondbacks are set to finish their homestand with a weekend series against the Atlanta Braves on Friday, April 25th through Sunday, April 27th. The game times are going to be on Friday at 6:40 p.m., Saturday at 5:10 p.m., and Sunday at 1:10 p.m., respectively. And that's the article, D-backs finish road trip, return home to face Rays and Braves. Our next article in the sports section is the WNBA program to combat harassment, written by Amy Tenery for Reuters News Group out of New York. The WNBA commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, announced a new program to ensure player safety, combating online hate and in-person vitriol, as athletes across all women's sports say a surge in popularity has made them more vulnerable. The WNBA welcomed an influx of new fans last year with the runaway popularity of then-rookie Caitlin Clark and her charismatic draft class, spiking ratings and in-person attendance across the league. But with the increase in attention came an uptick in racist and sexist abuse, players said, demanding last year that the league do more to address the issue. The league assembled an off-season task force to address the problem. Engelbert told this to the reporters ahead of Monday's WNBA draft in New York City. They created a multidimensional approach to combating hate and vitriol. She said, quote, it will include 1, monitoring of social media and other digital platforms using an advanced technology solution to detect and monitor comments and threats, and 2, strengthening our conduct standards across all WNBA platforms, including in the arena. There will be added security measures put in place at the league and team levels. And 4, there will be continued services of dedicated mental health clinicians, unquote. Stalking, threats, and harassment have been an unwanted byproduct of the growing popularity and media exposure for women's sports, with 2021 U.S. Open winner Emma Raducanu spotting a stalker during a match at the Dubai Championships this year. Indianapolis police arrested a Texas man earlier this year on stalking charges after he allegedly sent threats and sexually violent messages to the Indiana Fever star Clark. Another man reportedly pleaded guilty to a stalking charge late last year after police arrested him for harassing UConn star Paige Buckers, the presumed first overall pick in Monday's WNBA draft. Engelbert said, quote, we want to ensure that the WNBA remains a space where everyone, players, fans, and corporate partners, feel safe, valued, and empowered. Unquote. And that was the article, WNBA Program to Combat Harassment. We just passed 30 minutes past the hour. It's time for us to go read some opinion pieces. The first opinion piece is at the top of the Viewpoints page. It was written by Phil Boas, who's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, Trump Now Sounds Like Tax the Rich Democrat. Here's what Phil wrote. A few years ago, Republicans began asking a question to trip up opponents who had pushed transgender issues to the forefront. What is a woman? When Democrats and liberals could not answer without sputtering like old Model Ts, you knew they had never thought that their project to reorganize society and language around a new deity, gender fluidity. But today, if Democrats want to repay the favor, they can ask the conservatives a different question. What is a Republican? Well, the answer should be easy. In fact, everybody knows the answer, but no one is eager to say it. So the Pistons spit and sputter. Only a decade ago, the Republican Party stood for freedom. The engine of American freedom was the free market, in which individual Americans make many of life's most consequential decisions with their own hard-earned cash. To remain free, the market must be unburdened by heavy taxes and regulation and other manipulations of government. That was the ideal. The GOP did not always live up to it. The Republican philosophy was largely shaped by the Chicago School of Economics and its principles of rational behavior, limited government, deregulation, and free trade. Today, the head of the Republican Party, Donald Trump, is anything but a free trader. He has launched, quote, the most restrictive American tariff regime since the 1930s, unquote. That's according to the Trump-friendly National Review. The last Republicans to try this were Senators Reed Smoot of Utah and Willis Hawley of Oregon. Their 1930 Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act helped deepen the Great Depression and ensure that Smoot and Hawley faced ignominious defeat the next time they faced voters in 1932. Donald Trump's tariffs are beginning to look like one of the great blunders in history. After inheriting a relatively healthy economy, with most data moving in the right direction, Trump has managed to steer the ship toward recession. A recent Wall Street Journal survey found that 64 academic and business economists now believe the likelihood of a recession is now a coin flip, 48%. Last January, that projection was 22%. Leading the way over the cliff is consumer confidence, which has fallen to a 45-year low, according to the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. The Make America Great Again Coalition is a change agent and a disruptor. It has so shaken the table of American politics that it isn't clear where any of us are going to land in the future. And I mean Democrats, too. A case in point came earlier this month when Donald Trump defended his tariffs with this post on Truth Social. Quote, I'm proud to be the president for the workers, not the outsourcers. The president who stands up for Main Street, not Wall Street. Who protects the middle class, not the political class. And who defends America, not trade cheaters all over the globe. Unquote. To which former Meet the Press host Chuck Todd responded on X, quote, sounds like Dem Party talking points from the Mondale campaign of 84. It's amazing how the two parties have almost completely swapped economic ideologies, unquote. It's been only 4 years since Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made a progressive splash with her red-on-white tax-the-rich ball gown at the Met Gala. And now comes word that Trump could tax the rich to pay for tax cuts for the middle class, the kind of class warfare you don't expect from a Republican. Three sources have told Semaphore that Trump told Republican senators at a private gathering in early April that, quote, he's open to raising tax rates on some of the highest earning Americans, unquote. In National Review, Rich Lowry compares Trump to the old Democrat warhorse Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Quote, what fundamentally unites FDR and Trump, though, is a big man view of the presidency as an overwhelming force that takes the rest of the system and the country by the scruff of the neck and pushes it wherever the president wants to go, unquote. As FDR did some 80 years ago, Trump is expanding executive power by declaring an emergency and then using presidential authority to attack the emergency, Lowry explained. Lowry quotes historian Richard Hofstadter and asks his readers to imagine, who does this sound like? Quote, at the heart of the New Deal was not a philosophy, but a temperament. The essence of that temperament was Roosevelt's confidence that even when he was operating in unfamiliar territory, he could do no wrong, commit no serious mistakes, unquote. So as Trump strides confidently into a trade war with the rest of the world and a possible recession, a number of liberal Democrats, while still critical, are sympathetic to his pangs for the working man and woman. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer got hit by her own party when she said she gets the motivation behind tariffs and that she is, quote, not against tariffs outright, unquote. Colorado Governor Jared Polis criticized Whitmer's comment, saying the tariff hammer winds up hitting your own hand rather than the nail, unquote. If it's been hard for Democrats to resist Trump's protectionism, it is because their constituents in labor have long favored protectionist trade policies. In a piece this month in the Free Press, Batya Ungar Sargon explains why she made the journey from liberal Democrat to liberal Trump supporter. She wrote, quote, by now it's no secret that we've just witnessed a massive political realignment along class lines as the Democrats abandoned labor to cater to the over-credentialed college elites, and Donald Trump became the candidate for the multiracial working class. The Democrats now represent 9 of the top 10 richest congressional districts in America, as well as 65% of Americans making over $500,000 a year, unquote. Well, as the party of the rich and powerful, old Democrats have a dilemma. How do you look out for the little guy, and when you represent the wants and needs of the upper class? But for Republicans, the dilemma is even starker. What is a Republican? No one wants to answer the question because the answer is so obvious. A Republican is whatever the hell Donald Trump says it is. And that was Phil Boas's opinion piece, Trump Now Sounds Like Tax the Rich Democrat. Our next opinion piece is written by Elvia Diaz. Arizona should not let anyone use food stamps to buy soda. Arizona Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs blew up the chance to ban the use of food stamps on sodas. And why did she do it? Her answer is a head-scratcher that leads any reasonable person to conclude that she vetoed the Republican-backed bill over politics at the expense of Arizona's most vulnerable. Hobbs wrote in explaining her veto to Republican House Speaker Steve Montenegro, quote, I appreciate your intent to improve the health outcomes of Arizonans, unquote. Really? Well, if she believes that, then she should have signed the legislation that would help promote healthy foods. Instead, Hobbs thought it was brought into the erroneous idea that prohibiting food stamps to buy sodas would unnecessarily deprive these recipients of their purchasing power, and that, quote, relegates them to a new underclass of grocery shoppers, unquote. I don't understand the logic. Hobbs had earlier signed bipartisan legislation banning certain artificial dyes and other chemicals from what can be served at public schools, including what's available in vending machines. The only difference between these two bills was support from Democratic lawmakers. The Democrats apparently could not stomach giving Republicans a win, period. Absolutely nobody argued that there is nutritional value to sodas. Nobody. So why not restrict it? Democratic Senator Annalise Ortiz argued that this isn't about sodas, but rather an attempt by government to regulate the diet of those who need food stamps, which are mostly poor people. Again, I don't understand this logic. Food stamps, or what's now known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, are designed to help the poor. Yes, the poor, because the rich don't need government assistance to buy basic food. The goal, as indicated in the program's title, is to provide nutrition to those who need it. So what's wrong with adhering to that mission? This type of government assistance is crucial to ensure that nobody goes hungry in this wealthy country of ours. The program does not regulate users as an underclass of grocery shoppers, like Hobbs and other Democrats have argued. These folks, unfortunately, are already poor. Otherwise, they would not need the assistance. I see nothing wrong with putting some restrictions on the type of food that can be purchased with our tax dollars. Recipients have the choice of not taking that assistance if they don't like it. We must be willing to recognize that we have a junk food crisis in this country that manifests everywhere. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Donald Trump's head of the Federal Department of Human and Health Services, is the worst possible person to be championing the fight against junk food. Kennedy, who came to Phoenix to back the soda ban bill that Hobbs later vetoed, is a conspiracy theorist on many fronts. But he is not wrong about what junk food is doing to America. House Bill 2165 doesn't even ban sodas outright. It was merely the first step to let Arizona ask permission from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to do it. Trump's and MAGA's motives against certain groups of people, including the poor, are horrifying and scary. But they are not wrong about making sure that government money goes toward nutritious food. Nobody will suffer if they can't buy sodas instead of fruits, vegetables, eggs, and bread. Handing out food stamps in perpetuity is not the answer to our wealth inequality in America. It's a helping hand, with some restrictions, to those who need it while they get back on their feet. And that was the opinion by Elvia Diaz entitled, Arizona Should Not Let Anyone Use Food Stamps to Buy Soda. I think we've got a couple minutes here where we can read some opinions written by people like you and me in the section of the paper known as the Letters to the Editor. The first letter goes like this. Clark Miller's April 11th guest column, Your AC Unit Needs an Upgrade, and the Arizona Legislature Should Help Pay for It, he made some excellent points about air conditioners. However, in discussing Arizona's heat, I think he missed one very important component, trees. Trees, when properly planted, provide natural cooling effects. Trees reflect solar radiation, clean the air by removing climate-warming dioxide, and can reduce the temperature by 4 to 5 degrees. And they are lovely to look at. The legislature could require builders to provide a shade tree with every new house. They could do the same with large blacktop parking lots, requiring that they too have shade trees. They might develop a tree formula for every square foot of blacktop. SRP recently offered a free shade tree program in which residents could get 2 free shade trees to plant. I heard they gave away more than 1,500 trees along with the planting instructions. That certainly is a step in the right direction, but more must be done. It's way past time for the Arizona legislature to do something positive for residents who are about to face another record-breaking summer. Signed, Sandra Givens in Sun Lakes. Ruben Gallego is proving himself to being nothing more than a worthless tag-along to U.S. Adam Schiff's anti-Trump diatribes. He promised to work for Arizona's interest, not against. The only thing this man has done over the past several years is to alienate Arizona from our president. Yet here we are reaping his failures. What has he accomplished for Arizona? Is he a waste of our time and money? I believe so. In the future, vote for anyone but Gallego. Signed, Alan Griggs in Buckeye. E.J. Montini is right. In his April 10th column, entitled Trump Channels His Inner Putin Against Two Critics, That Should Make You Sick, unquote, he argues that Donald Trump is trying to criminalize truth-telling. Montini chose a good example in Trump's targeted investigations of the two former employees from his first term. But that's just one example. There are many more. Rounding up students here on visas for publicly telling the truth about what Israel is doing to the people in Gaza. Threatening to shutter the National Museum of African American History and Culture, a part of the Smithsonian, for truthfully portraying the experiences of black Americans. Threatening to primary any Republican who dares to tell the truth about the 2020 election. Threatening to investigate and prosecute the members of the House Select Committee on January 6th. Their crime was uncovering the truth about what really happened leading up to and on January 6th. Donald Trump's disdain for the truth is becoming more and more evident. Although it kind of makes sense because narcissists like to create their own reality, when the truth contradicts that false reality, it has to be destroyed. This is who millions of Americans chose to be their president. It was a mistake, and that is the truth. Signed, Dan Peel in Scottsdale. At 46 minutes past the hour, we're moving on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. We will begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Your heart may be frustrated by financial realities. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, observe your foundation. Internal dynamics are at play. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, you may struggle with impulsive communication. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, long-term dreams may be at odds with urgent needs. For Leo, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, your ambition is off the charts. Channel this energy wisely. A frustrating obstacle may test your patience and dedication. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, every little thing may annoy you today. Rise above it. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, the universe gives you the green light. While there is tension around solidifying real-world changes. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, partnerships and ambitions may be in conflict. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, reality may hamper an ambitious leap. Freedom to act can feel risky. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates. The fire of your desire is blazing. Creativity and romance are supercharged. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates. Prepare for defensive reactions on the home front. Stubborn pride can ignite a domestic stalemate. And finally, Pisces. Birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Your plate may be full today. Maintaining a work-life balance is tested. That was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. Our first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my daughter was living in my garage apartment, but then she got married and moved away. Her sister is in law school in another state, and her brother is even farther away in graduate school. I moved close enough to see them when they come to visit their hometown and their mother. My ex-wife is flying the two out-of-state ones in for a visit, and I asked her if I could take them to lunch or dinner one of the days they're here. She replied that because she paid for the flights, she doesn't have to let me have any time with them. She seems to have forgotten that she owes me more money than she spent to fly the kids in. The last time I asked, she said I could come to her house to see them, but that was it. Because she's being so unkind about this, I wouldn't be comfortable. I guess I'm venting because there's really nothing I can do. Any ideas on how not to feel bad about this? Signed, Sad Dad in Texas. Abby responds, Dear Dad, Your children are not kids. They're adults now. If you want to see them while they're in town, you don't need to ask your ex-wife. Reach out to them directly. Ask what they would like to do. From your description of your relationship with your ex, it's clear that you are not friendly, but don't let that stop you. You didn't mention how close your bond is with your son and soon-to-be lawyer daughter, but if it's not too late, keep working to improve it. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, for as far back as I can remember, I have eaten my meals one item at a time. Now, I know this is different from the way most people do it. I have observed that most people eat a bite of each food on their plate smooshed together. I tried in the past to combine my foods, but I do not enjoy the flavor as much as eating them separately. When I eat my eggs over medium, I cut the whites out and eat them first, and then I scoop up the yolks without breaking them and eat them in one delicious bite. When I was growing up, my dad would suggest that I combine my food, but he never forced me to do it. I'm retired now, and once a week I go to breakfast with a friend who watches me eat my eggs and accuses me of being eccentric. Should I change the way I eat in public, or am I entitled to be comfortable? Am I eccentric? Signed, One at a Time in California. And Abby responds, Dear One at a Time, if you think you are alone in eating each item separately, allow me to offer some comfort by telling you it is exactly what I do, including cutting the whites off the eggs. Maybe we are both eccentric, or we have a touch of OCD, but heck, who cares? It's our food, and we're going to enjoy it just the way we want to. Those were our letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. She put a note at the bottom of the column to my readers. For those who celebrate Easter, I wish all of you a meaningful and memorable day. Happy Easter, everyone. Don't forget, Dear Abby is written by Abigail Van Buren. She's also known as Jean Phillips. The column was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. And you can contact her in two different ways. One way is to go to her website, www.dearabby.com. The other is to write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. That's the zip code, 90069. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Time now for a couple of comics. In the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in the first frame, there is this woman at a dinner table, and there's one, two, three, four, five, six of the guys from camp, five guys from camp at the table, and it's a woman on one end of the table and a man on the other end. And the woman says, "It's nice of you boys to visit." And one of the privates says, "Thank you for inviting us, Mrs. Bailey." So I guess the woman and the man are Beetle's parents. And then Private Zero says, "The food is delicious." And in the next frame, Sergeant Snorkel says, "Nothing like a home-cooked meal." And then Beetle says, "Nothing like a meal not cooked by Cookie." And that was Beetle Bailey. And in the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, in the first frame, there's Dagwood standing at the door. Three little kids in front of him, y'all go, "Happy Easter, Mr. B." And they hold up their Easter baskets, and he's taking eggs out of his Easter basket and putting them in each of theirs. He says, "Happy Easter, guys." The next frame, he's got the door closed. He's starting to walk away from the door, and the doorbell goes off. Ding dong, ding dong. Next frame, three more people, little people, and "Happy Easter, Mr. B." And he goes, "Happy Easter, guys," and he's handing out Easter eggs. And in the next frame, he's almost made it back to the couch, and the doorbell goes off again. Ding dong. The next frame, there's like four or five little kids. "Happy Easter, Mr. B." And he says, "Happy Easter," as he drops eggs into all of theirs baskets. And in the last frame, he's laying on the couch trying to take his nap, and the doorbell goes off, ding dong, and he says, "Man, for some reason, Easter always seems to wear me out." And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Peanuts, drawn by Charles Schulz, first frame, there's Lucy, got her hat on, baseball hat on, her glove on her hand, standing in the field. She says, "We're right behind you, pitcher," sort of. Next frame, Charlie Brown winds up. Next frame, he lets go of the ball. The next frame, pow! The ball comes right through him, knocks him down. And the next frame, Lucy comes up and he's laying on the mound. And she says, "Oh, you look so cute lying there, Charlie Brown, with your little Easter toes sparkling in the sun." And the next frame, Charlie Brown says, "Get back out in the center field where you belong." And then in the last frame, Lucy's walking back and she says, "How can a pitcher be so crabby on Easter?" And that was Charlie Brown. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, there's Mom and Dad, just one picture. They're standing in the kitchen, and their mom's in her bathrobe, and Dad's got, looks like pajama pants on, plaid, and a hoodie. And the door's open from the backyard into the house. And the three kids are coming in from outdoors, and they're carrying huge baskets, and they're stuffed with little Easter eggs. And Mom says they can hunt 100 Easter eggs in 2 minutes, but they need all weekend to find their library books. So true. That was Baby Blues. Time for us to wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Happy birthday and congratulations to George Takei. He turns 88 today. Veronica Cartwright turns 76. Jessica Lange turns 76. Clint Howard turns 66. And Carmen Electra turns 53. And Joey Lawrence turns 49. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 20th, 2025. Have a great day.